Well, first up this half hour to a specialist perspective on the Middle East from a man who spends a lot of time on the ground there. And of course, in Iraq, there's still no result in sight over a month after it held its much-touted general elections. And the country's facing further long delays as Iraq's incumbent prime minister called for a recount in five provinces amid claims of widespread fraud. And this development doesn't reflect well on hopes that Iraq could go it alone after US forces handed over the reins of power to the Iraqis. In fact, it doesn't bode well for President Barack Obama's key foreign policy focus, namely the Middle East. If anything, US efforts in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and Israel have achieved nothing more than to reveal the intractability of the problems in the region. That, at least, is the firm view of Gilles Kepel. He's the Philippe Roman Chair in History and International Relations at the London School of Economics, also Chair in Middle East Mediterranean Studies at the Institute of Political Studies in Paris, and he's here in Canberra as a guest of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. Welcome to Radio National Breakfast, Gilles.
Hello, good morning.
Could the power vacuum that we're seeing now in Iraq, which by all accounts could last for months, do you think it could lead to further bloodshed? Like, we've seen the insurgents re-emerge in ways that we haven't seen for quite a while. Do you think that this is a portent for the future?
Yeah, it's a very big problem because there is no clear winner in the present election, you know, and as you just mentioned, the incumbent Prime Minister, Nour el-Maliki, is asking for a recount, and therefore it looks like there's a lot of trouble ahead, all the more so as recently the movement, the Shia movement, which is headed by Muqtada Sadr, the radical cleric who's now hosted by Iran, has organized a sort of referendum between its supporters, saying that they wanted neither Maliki, the present prime minister, nor Alawi, who won the elections, but they wanted a third person who's closer to Iran. And this, of course, is going to make things extremely difficult, particularly in the light of the American military pullout, which should take place, which will start really being put into action as of June. This is going to be a major problem. Also, the Kurds, who were, if you wish, the kingmakers in the previous electoral balance, have lost that situation, that position now to the radical Shias.
Well, in fact, one of the interesting results from that election was the survival, the thriving secular parties. So it would sort of feel as if the Iraqi citizen is trying to say, we want a different Iraq. And of course, the political players won't accept it.
Well, it's a little more complicated because much of the press has insisted on the fact that Alawi, who went slightly ahead than Maliki, was a secular leader. Well, originally he's a secularist in his mind, he's a Shiite secularist, if you want. But the most important thing is that he managed to garner the votes of many of the Sunnis on his name, the Iraqi Sunnis, who represent grossly or roughly 25% of the population, the Arab Sunnis, not the Kurds, were leading Iraq under Saddam Hussein. And they were marginalized as soon as the American and their allies invaded Iraq in the spring of 2003. Then they were the backbone of the insurgency. Afterwards, they were brought back into the political process thanks to General Petraeus's policy and also probably thanks to a lot of Saudi funding. And now Alawi was heavily supported by Saudi Arabia also. So it's not really a secularist politician, if you want, but it's...
But it's cross-partisan. That was what was making it so interesting, wasn't it?
A cross-partisan or a cross-denominational, if you wish, alliance, which in a way is secularist. But I was in Iraq late January, and it was striking at the time Maliki was in power, and the whole city looked like the southern values of Beirut or Tehran, because everywhere you had portraits of the Shiite imams on display and so on and so forth. This probably sort of angered many people who are not Shias or who within the Shia community do not feel that their religiosity is first and foremost.
Yes. In fact, you write very interestingly about what it's like for Middle Easterners, for people who are living there on the ground, because you do go there quite a lot. And you say the region is, in fact, more than I think we even get in headlines, a tinderbox at the moment, that particularly people in a place like Lebanon, they really fear war.
Well, to a large extent, and they're very, you know, Lebanon is particularly dear to the hearts of Australians because there's a very significant Lebanese community here.
Indeed.
Which to a large extent reflects the inner tensions of Lebanon with a rather established Maronite Christian community, a Shiite community and a Sunni community in which there were a number of problems of late in Lokamba and other places in Sydney, which predominantly is a community that suffers from a lack of upward social mobility, and that to some extent is a mirror image of what is happening nowadays in Lebanon, where you have the Shiite party Hezbollah, which has now become the leading party in the whole of Lebanon because the Shiite community is the most numerous, marginalizing now the former dominating Maronite or Christian community. Now, for the Christians in Lebanon to survive, they have to make alliance either with the Shiites or the Sunnis. So you have the Sunni Christians and the Shiite Christians, which is, of course, a paradox. And in a way, the present-day Lebanon is in part and parcel the sort of the ripple effect zone of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, a crisis which is nowadays in a very problematic situation.
Well, in fact, Gilles Capella is our guest on Breakfast. He's a Middle East specialist, and it's 12 minutes past 8. In fact, you write about the interlocking nature of what you think are the three main crises in the Middle East. You say Israel and Palestine, you just referred to that, the Gulf crisis over oil between the Arabs and the Iranians, and the Afghanistan-Pakistan crisis, AFPAC as you call it. Interestingly, you don't even put Iraq in there. So our headlines get it wrong, do they?
No. Iraq is part and parcel of the Gulf crisis because Iraq is a Gulf country, if you wish, and it has 46 kilometers on the Gulf, but it's clearly at the heart of the. Hello.
Yes. We're with you.
Hello.
Oh, can you hear us, Gilles?
Hello.
We're with you, hello. Gilles. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, we're here. No, obviously, he's getting a lot of cross-feed for some
Sorry.
Reason.
Sorry, but there was some problem on the line. Hello?
Yes, Gilles, you having difficulty. We might ring you back. We'll come back to you, Gilles, and get
hello?
A better line.
I'm sorry, it looks like there's something on the line. So Iraq is right on the middle of the Gulf crisis because, you know, it is predominantly Shiite, though it is Arab. It is a major oil exporting country that cannot export its oil because it could not drill. Mm. And it is also a phenomenon which is right at the heart of the American failure to reshuffle the cards in the Middle East. So in a way, it is something which has to do with this. It's quintessential to this the interlocking three axes of crisis in the Middle East today.
Well, in fact, attitudes towards the Iranians, I think, in a way, our headlines tend to suggest that the Anglo-Saxons and the West is worried about the Iranians. You point out, of course, that the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates are arguably much more worried about the Iranians than the West is. Where do you see this going?
Well, definitely the problem, you know, for the time being is that the Gulf, most people call it the Persian Gulf, the Arabs want to call it the Arabian Gulf, well, the difference on the names is also is already the beginning of the problem, of course. The Gulf is the place out of which 1/4 of oil consumption gets out every day. So, you know, the Palestine-Israeli crisis is the most important symbolically. It's the sort of most ancient and resilient crisis. But it doesn't impede you from taking your car to go to work every morning. Whereas if the Straits of Hormuz are locked, out of which 25% of the oil leaves every day, then you'll have to get your bicycle. Which of course is going to change the life of everyone. Mm. Hence, it's a very difficult issue. And for the time being, oil production in the Gulf is dominated by the Arabs, by Saudi Arabia, and by the little Gulf states which are nearby on the Arabian Peninsula. Iraq is largely out of the game because it was destroyed under Saddam Hussein, even though it probably has the second largest reserves in the world, and so is Iran because of the sanctions. And so if we have a nuclear Iran that is in full capacity to recover its drilling possibilities, then the Arabs in the peninsula, in the Arabian Peninsula, fear that the whole Gulf area will become an Iranian protectorate. And for that reason, they are very worried, and they're also bothered okay. because they think that the Obama administration was originally too soft on Iran and did not protect them.
All right, Gilles Kepel, I hope we're not discussing this in the same way in 5 years' time. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was leading Middle East analyst Gilles Kepel, who is here as a guest of the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. His latest book is called Beyond Terror and Martyrdom. It's published by Belknap. And it's 16 minutes past 8.